I'm a fan of Tottenham now. Oh, that's cool. I hate Arsenal. Adele's a fan of Tottenham.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap to some people who were really smart made up and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the room, our senior minister for sport.
Yes!
Kate Fagan. Hello, Kate.
See, that sounds so foreign. I love it.
I thought, you know, we'd give you a little
thank you. Have you thought about it
thing.
All week?
Yeah, I have. And then I scribbled it down on my page.
You were like, I need a new one, different. If you were going to say sort of like global ambassador, I was going to be like, I've heard that one before. But we haven't done sports minister.
Yeah. But Kate, your star is rising so quickly that I don't know, what's the next step for you? Do you have like growth opportunities?
What promotion could I get from sports minister?
Yeah, I don't even know.
I mean, you got to be pretty high up.
Do I get
right?
knighted next?
President? Ooh, I like that. Ooh. Order of sports.
What's a female knight is not sir, but lady?
I don't know.
Is it lady?
It sounds like it
Madame?
Should be.
It's yeah. probably lady.
Judy Dench.
Great. Excellent. Glad we solved that mystery.
Yep.
Dame Kate Fagan.
That other voice you hear is Neil Paynes. Hello, Neil.
Hey, Chad.
Neil, sharp Mets hat today.
Thank you.
Perhaps the seventh Mets hat I've seen on you this season.
Well, you know, I try to have a rotation so that if things start to go badly, I can kind of switch
Did
up
the luck.
Did one
of them have Tommy John surgery, your hat?
Yeah, well, one of them got run over by a truck, which is the equivalent of having Tommy John
still
surgery.
Still feeling some ulnar nerve damage afterwards.
Yes.
All right. On today's show, we are going to talk about the NFL competitive balance and what is going wrong with the Seahawks. Is anything going wrong with the Seahawks? That was
They're
sort of
fine.
A loaded
it's
going to
be fine.
We will then talk about the WNBA, the playoffs of which start this week, and their very interesting new playoff format, and whether or not it leads to better results or more random results. And then we will talk about the EPL, that is the English Premier League, and soccer. Mike Goodman, ESPN's Mike Goodman, will swing by and talk about Jose Mourinho, which I think it's Jose Mourinho, I realize.
Jose.
Sounds classier.
Versus Pep Guardiola and that rivalry that knows no bounds. Okay, on to football, where some of the teams that we thought might struggle early in the year because of offseason changes, like the Broncos and the Patriots, are 2-0. And some of the teams that we were expecting to be pretty good, the Seahawks, for example, have struggled in getting to where they are. The Seahawks 1-1. Neil, I want to start with you and just talk about competitive balance around the league after 2 weeks, and sort of where things stand, because it does seem like things are a little more scrambled than I was expecting.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. You know, we talked about Denver before the season and about how we weren't sure about them, but then they seem to be playing fine as befitting the team that, you know, mostly brought back, aside from their quarterback, who was not actually very good last year, brought back most of the pieces from the Super Bowl champs. Carolina continues to play well. New England has pretty much weathered the loss of Tom Brady. These are all kind of things that we had up in the air, but these are solid teams that have sort of established themselves again and confirm themselves as belonging in that upper echelon. And maybe Pittsburgh has also joined that group. But then, like you mentioned, Seattle is a team that people probably rightly had at the top of whatever kind of power rankings they had going in the season or near the top, and they have not looked like they belong there. Kansas City is a team that people thought could be a sort of dark horse, maybe pick up the AFC West if Denver falters. They have not looked particularly sharp. Green Bay is a team that, with Jordy Nelson healthy, people thought, oh, you know, maybe it'll be back to usual with Aaron Rodgers. So the next tier of teams, I guess maybe like the top tier has kind of split into ones that have lived up to expectations in the first 2 weeks and other ones where it's still, you know, more of a question mark. And the classification of those teams is not the same as perhaps we would have expected going into the season.
I'm tempted to just say, okay, well, it's such a small sample size, right?
Right?
Like we talk about. But then, you know, you guys have a piece up at 538 about how it's like crunch time in the NFL season now, and how much more, quote unquote, valuable early season wins are when you look at playoff projections. And so I'm wondering, though, because when you talk about, like, let's say the Seahawks, they are 1-1, so their playoff hopes aren't like super low. But you take another 0-2 team who maybe we didn't expect to be 0-2, and now they only have a 10% chance, right, of making the playoffs. And that data is from 1995. And it's not like the NFL has like changed in parity too much from then to now. But I'm wondering, because it seems like this year especially, we're seeing a lot of teams that we thought would be good start off poorly, which would then lead you to believe their playoff chances are low. Is there anything going, Neil, you, question for you. Is there anything going on within the NFL that you think like explains how maybe it's, there's even more parity being driven in, or how a 10% chance now for like a really good team to be 0-2, like, is there more noise, just say noise and I don't actually know what it means, more noise in that than we think?
I don't know, because we certainly, like, before the past maybe three seasons, it did look like the NFL was in kind of a more chaotic state than usual, and had been for a while. And this doesn't just go back to maybe like the late 90s, where teams would kind of jump from being in last place to first place in the division as kind of like a routine thing. But then you had teams like your New York Giants kind of, you know, going through the playoffs after not necessarily having the best track record during the regular season, and things being kind of wonky between seasons. So if you had a good season, you couldn't really tell if that team would carry over.
Right.
Those are all indications that we were in an era of parity. But then a few years ago, maybe like a switch flipped or something, and we started to be able to predict these things a lot better. The Seahawks emerged as kind of the clear number one team, and they went to two Super Bowls. The Patriots have kind of chugged along, and they, instead of being upset by the Jets in the division round, they went to the Super Bowl. They won the Super Bowl. So it seemed almost like a weird respite of predictability from what had become a chaotic NFL. And I don't know if that was the thing about these long-term historical trends, is it's so difficult to tell whether what the outlier is, right? Like, it was the years of sort of chaos, was that not the norm, and we should kind of expect, because the salary cap era in the 90s, you know, it spanned almost all of the 90s from probably like 93, you know, onward. It was very predictable. The Cowboys won two Super Bowls, won three Super Bowls, excuse me. The Bills went to a bunch of Super Bowls. And then after that, the Packers went to two Super Bowls. So things, the Broncos won two Super Bowls. You know, you kind of get the sense that that was a predictable era. Then we had an unpredictable era. Then it seemed like predictability was coming back. And now the start of this season is less predictable. And of course, it's only 2 weeks in. So
yeah, because like right now, the 0-2 teams in the NFL, if you just cognitively, if I have to think that they only have a 10% chance of getting to the playoffs, doesn't feel right. It almost feels like maybe those numbers now,
Well, what's the historical number for? Is it
10% if you start, go 0-2? Since 1995.
Right.
10%. And it just doesn't feel right to apply that percentage to some of the quality NFL teams who are 0-2.
Yeah, so our colleague Benjamin Morris has this sort of heat grid of outcomes, basically, that shows if you start the season, at any point during the season, actually, when your record is X and Y, what does that mean about your ultimate number of wins that you're going to have? Teams that
and
start,
your playoff chances.
Yeah,
right.
So teams that start 0-2 tend to, or on average, finish the season with 5.7 wins. Now, so that suggests like these teams are doomed if you just look at that way. But that's also taking into account that those two losses have a lot of information packed inside of them, right? And two losses are in the bag. There are only 14 more games
to
go.
Right, it's like a double whammy, right? Like you lose the games and that hurts you. And then also we learn that you're probably not as good as perhaps we originally thought you were. But what are the teams aside from maybe Washington? I'm looking at the 0-2 teams.
Cleveland.
Cleveland. Yeah, we were really thinking that they're going to jump out to a hot
start. I
thought
for sure with keeping 14 draft picks. No, I mean, I know Seattle's 1-1,
right.
But like they're like one play away from being 0-2. And
right.
Maybe
that's what I want to sort of dwell on, because the Seahawks have had a real bad time of it. And they've had 22 drives in their first two games. They've scored one touchdown. They've committed four turnovers and punted 13 times. that's not good. But what's interesting is that the difference between 1-1 and 0-2 on that ultimate win, end of season win chart that I was talking about, 0-2 teams win 5.7 games on average. 1-1 teams win 8.2 games on average. And so what's sort of hard to unpack is like the fact that the Seahawks could make that drive in their first game and were able to win, does that suggest that they are demonstrably better than a team that would otherwise have fallen to 0-1 and therefore 0-2?
Is that worth three wins this season? Right. That one pass from Russell Wilson to get that conversion?
Right. Do you win those extra games because you're better or because you won that extra game? And does it carry, you know, and I think Ben's thing definitely puts emphasis on that information that you gain. And so it kind of suggests that we learn that you're better because you won that game. But then there are always these edge cases, right, where, you know, maybe you didn't deserve to win the game or you deserve to win it only, you know, flip a coin to figure out how often you win that game. And then, you know, that's a case where we'd probably regress the leap a little bit to the mean and maybe give you less than that three-win leap based on what you've done. But also, you know, early season NFL results, even though they carry this weight that we talked about, you still have to really regress heavily toward your preseason expectations and probably do that for at least half the season or more because, you know, there's just so few games and so few chances for a team to kind of, you know, establish itself because the NFL does have so much parity and the teams are so bunched that it's tough to kind of distinguish yourself and it takes a lot of plays to do that. And unfortunately, through 2 weeks, we just don't have that many plays.
Right, because we're talking a lot about like 0-2 teams or the Seahawks being almost 0-2. A lot of my surprise is also looking at 2-0 teams and now wonder, you know, like Giants, specifically in the NFC East, like the Eagles. I don't think there's a lot of people thinking they would be 2-0. Giants, I think there was some confusion about how good they would be because of their new acquisitions on the defensive end.
But Minnesota after Bridgewater went down.
And so I think that's where you're like, when you point out like, what was the preseason expectation? Maybe that's where I'm like, well, I don't then think the Eagles and Giants are as good as 2-0.
Yeah, and you're right to think that. If you look at the ELO ratings, which we have, which are kind of
almost.
Oh yeah, we have we had preseason ones, which are just last year's final numbers regressed to the mean. Which sounds kind of dumb. You know, it sounds like it doesn't take into account player movement or quarterback changes or you know all of these things. But even having said that, they actually do a pretty good job. The teams don't really change their fundamental quality that much between seasons, or you know, it's tough to kind of figure out. You need more, you know, more of a sample into the season before you can definitively say that a team has changed. And so in some ways, they're kind of uniquely tailored for this very question of trying to figure out exactly how much do you change, like if you have a knob to tweak how well we think or poorly we think of a team, you know, am I aggressive and do I change it a lot or do I change it just a little small adjustment? And in the case of a team like, you know, Minnesota, they ended last season with a pretty good rating. This doesn't know Bridgewater went down, but then they got Bradford and then they started Sean Hill, but then they brought Bradford back and this, that, and the other. Now Peterson's down, but they really haven't moved that much on the needle, but they're ahead of a team like Baltimore, a team like the Giants, and a team like the Eagles, because they started last season from a lower spot, and so they started this season from a lower spot, and so it'll take more evidence and a greater sample of good play from them to convince a system, a statistical system, to kind of turn that dial more than it would for a team that was already pretty good, despite all the upheaval like a Minnesota.
So just to close the loop on Seattle, and I think we should move on to other topics. But Seattle, despite going 1-1, or I guess maybe because they've gone 1-1, this ELO rating still forecasts that they'll win 9.5 games and lose 6.5, and that takes into account strength of schedule and various other things. Now, it doesn't take into account, as Neil was saying, the actual underlying stats within those two games they've played, but it does sort of think about the teams they've beaten and not beaten, and so perhaps there's some material in the data that can clue us in on the future. Before we keep going with the show, let's hear a word from one of our sponsors this week. Hot Takedown is sponsored by DraftKings.com. At DraftKings.com, you don't need to come in first place to win some money. The player who finished 800th in week one's fantasy football contest on DraftKings, took home $100, 800th, $100. This weekend, DraftKings is hosting another huge fantasy contest with over $1 million in total prizes up for grabs. A reminder, for those of you who have not been listening to my beautiful ad reads of DraftKings, DraftKings is the destination for one-week fantasy football. One-week fantasy means no season-long commitments. You play whenever you want, with the players you want, and with whom you want. You pick your contest, you draft your team, you follow the action live as it unfolds. So don't wait. Get to DraftKings.com now and choose your players for this weekend's contest where there is a million, over $1 million in prizes up for grabs. Enter promo code TAKEDOWN when you do so and play for free with your first deposit. That is promo code TAKEDOWN to play for free for your share of over $1 million in total prizes only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website, DraftKings.com, for more details. Okay, now let's turn to the WNBA, whose playoffs begin this week. And those playoffs are different than they used to be. And they're also super interesting, I think, in the sort of design of them. So I'm going to run you through the way that they're going to work. They used to work where there's Eastern Conference and Western Conference, and there was a traditional bracket. And then two teams met in the finals. They played the best of five series, and someone won. Now, though, instead of the top teams being Eastern and Western, it's number one through number eight by record is the seeding, regardless of conference. So that's the first change. I want to pause
right, it's
there.
It's kind of what like the NBA has talked about possibly
right.
doing. And some people have said, well, let's see how it works in the WNBA.
So I want to pause there and just get your impressions about whether that will lead to any difference in the ultimate team that wins. Because I think we talk on the show a lot about the best way to design a playoff system so that the best team wins. In the NBA, for example, I think we feel like that grueling two-month slog does lead to the best team winning, aside from injury, perhaps, that being the downside of the slog. But here, rearranging the teams like that are going to make, I would think, the finals much more likely to have the two best regular season teams,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, I mean, I would having watched parts of the WNBA this year, I mean, I would think now you're looking at a situation where you couldn't have had the Sparks play the Lynx in the finals
right.
previously.
Because they're both Western Conference
teams. Both Western Conference teams. Now they're 1-2 in these 1-8 seedings, and you could conceivably see them in the finals, which from a fan perspective is a best case scenario.
And from a league perspective, I would think, too, we talk a lot here about how to build narrative into women's sports, and if you want to build rivalries within a conference and also have the stakes be highest when those great teams meet. And so this sort of gets to that where
yeah, you've definitely got that. You're losing the part where you're balancing the country
right.
out. I mean, they would obviously love the best if it was LA, New York, but the WNBA is a lot of people who care about it and know a lot about it. There's mm-hmm. not going to be a lot of casual New Yorkers tuning in anyway. So for the WNBA system, having those two teams is the best.
Right, and that's a complaint that you hear about in a lot of different sports of teams because of the particulars and the arbitrariness of cutoffs of conferences or divisions that, you know, good teams that deserve it get left out over teams at the bottom of the weaker conference that get to go in. So I like the idea of seeding things straight through, and I would wonder if maybe if this does work out that it would plant a seed in the head of, you know, Adam Silver to look at this is something that they've talked about in the NBA for a long time too, of why not just take the 16 best teams instead of using
right.
this arbitrary so conference division.
Yes. I was just going to say, like, people love open floor plans now, and they used to hate like all the rooms were like compartmentalized, but that's how it used to be now. And now 40 years later, we're like, well, why would we ever have wanted like such small rooms? We want an open floor plan.
Sports interior basketball design.
So I feel like 20 years from now they're gonna be like, why did we ever have these conferences?
Right.
That's so strange that we ever did this. We want to be able to cook and see the TV at the same time.
And it's such a relic of the times in which you kind of regionality ruled and
right.
you couldn't watch any game that you wanted at any time on television.
Right,
exactly. So now it's not a matter of restricting things to regional distinctions. You
can have your stereo system in all of the rooms,
right.
so why do you need
right.
to have it compartmentalized?
Let's calm down with the Sonos
great
ad.
Comparison, Kate.
Let's get back to WNBA playoffs, because there is another twist So this reordering of the 1-8, getting rid of the conferences and the playoffs, the top two seeds get an automatic bye into the semifinals, while seeds 3-8 face off in the first round of the playoffs. That means that the top two seeds will not play a game for 12 days. So it's more weighting it towards the top two. But then I'm wondering, Neil, if there's been any study around the effect that long bouts of rest has on sports teams. People talk about it all the time. They're right. Rusty. They, you know, it's been so long. Sweeping a series is actually maybe not as good as winning a series in six games because you have to have a week off. But I wonder, 12 days off after the end of a season in which teams played 34 games actually sounds pretty good, I bet. But
I'm wondering if there, because that is like always that hot button topic in the NBA playoffs and in all, like, are you rusty or are you rested?
Rest versus rust.
And then there's the added element of in the WNBA, like they're also coming off of not just the 34 games, but like the winter.
Schedule. Right.
And so I'm almost kind of leaning toward the time off is even better.
Wasn't there a huge Olympic break in the middle of the season also?
There was a huge Olympic, there was like 3 weeks or so. But it's like Maya Moore isn't going to benefit from, it's like the stars that are doing the heavy lifting aren't benefiting, but overall you're right.
But Neil, is there any correlation between rest and winning or losing that you know of?
I believe Andrew Flowers, our colleague at 538, and I looked at this during the playoffs, just the NBA playoffs this past year, of just time between the end of one playoff series and the start of the next to see if teams, you know, overperformed or underperformed based on the number of days of rest that they had. And I believe what we found was that there was no effect, which is not surprising. These narratives kind of always strike me as bullshit.
These are professional basketball players.
They can go play one day. They can go see your baby be born.
Yeah. But I don't know about these situations. Like, obviously, the most time that you would ever have between the end of your the end of your series and the end of your opponent's series is maybe a week in the NBA playoffs or something like that, if that. Whereas here we're talking about what's the maximum number, like with the bye, 12 days. Now it does come at the end of a season, but it's a relatively short season, and like you said, there's the differing levels of gruelingness because of the Olympics and all of this. And so if it were like the NFL, I would imagine NFL players are probably like just gulping down any amount of rest that they can possibly get. But then, you know, in the WNBA and just basketball seems like a less grueling sport. That's easy for me to say. But, so I don't know what the effect is. I don't know if anyone studied it.
Okay. So just to reiterate, the favorites to get to the finals are Minnesota and Los Angeles. Minnesota had the best record this season and I think also won the matchups with Los Angeles, if I remember correctly.
That was a sig dig of ours.
Right. And so Minnesota won 28-6 and Los Angeles, the Sparks, went 26-8. But I also want to talk about Nneka Ogumike, who we spoke about earlier this season. She's the Sparks forward, I believe, who has led the Sparks to the number two seed in the playoffs. Isn't leading the league in points scored and rebounds, but is very high up there. But is leading the league in all sorts of advanced stats. And this is part of what we talked about, I guess, probably a couple months ago.
And Chad, that's what really matters, okay?
Is the
win shares,
stats.
Player efficiency rating.
So Ogumike's true shooting percentage, Neil, real quick, that is?
Yeah, true shooting percentage is just a measure of how many points you score per shot attempt, which also includes free throw attempts.
And factors into account how many points are possible with the shots that you take, right?
Correct. Well, no, it actually gives you, you know, it doesn't ding you for taking threes.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So that true shooting percentage is 73.8%, the best in league history. There's only been one other player to finish with 70 or better.
That would be Candace Dupree in 2010. Just wanted to point that out.
Thank you, Neil. Always ready.
I kind of now want to know Wilt Chamberlain's true shooting percentage. It was like 67 or whatever when he shot like 71% from the field, but we don't know. Well, I don't know off the top of my head what his true shooting percentage
was. His true shooting percentage was 689,
68.9. What was his final shooting percentage of just regular shooting percentage? Not true.
The
year that he led the league, and it's the highest field goal percentage in league history, I thought it was like 67.
Yeah, so that was, in 1972/73, Wilt Chamberlain shot a staggering 72.7% from
that's
the floor.
One.
And he also
and
had
his true.
A 68.9% true shooting percentage.
So Ogumokwe's true shooting percentage in the WNBA this
better.
Year was
better
than
Wilt.
Because you guys, we don't understand a female athlete's excellence
it.
Unless we have a male proxy. That is why
you did
I
it,
offered
Kate.
Up
you
Wilt Chamberlain
this.
So that listeners can be like, now I understand.
Whoa. Now I understand.
Now I get it.
I would say she is more of a LeBron type player than a
true.
Wilt Chamberlain.
But I had to go with somebody with super high field goal percentage. Mm.
Okay,
I would say her teammate Candace Parker, more of a Wilt.
So her other advanced stats are fantastic. Her wins above replacement player, best in the league by two full wins, leads the league in player efficiency rating, win shares, offensive rating. It just seems like we're witnessing one of the great seasons of women's basketball, and I feel like no one's talking about it, right?
Well, yeah, in large part because like Candace Parker is more famous, right, from like a casual fan's perspective, and also because most casual fans like can't relate to all those numbers you just said. And you pointed out that her like the numbers they can relate to, like points and rebounds, are lovely, but they're not like eye-popping,
right? And I think that's the real split, is that especially when there's already a barrier of entry for fans to get interested in women's sports, putting another barrier of entry, which is advanced statistics, right, on top of the fact, like, that it's a women's sport.
Oh, you don't care about women's sports, but let me tell you about this one athlete.
Right. It's asking them to make kind of two leaps of faith from what they're not used to. But yeah, it really is crazy. I mean, her stats, and that was why I wrote that story about her a few months ago, was so not only the stats are amazing, like you mentioned, and they're, you know, just like eye-popping video game numbers, if video games were to track advanced statistics.
And have
like
female athletes playing them.
And have female athletes. But the other thing is, it is kind of out of left field. When I did when I looked at her numbers a couple months ago, which pretty much she didn't drop off that much from them, let's just put it that way, before the end of the season. It was the biggest single season improvement in WNBA history, and it's not even close to the second best. And there was like a 1 in 2,000 chance of her, based on her track record going into this season, which was, you know, a solid like 4 or 5 years of track record under her belt as a pro. You know, she was the number one overall pick, but no one was really could have seen this coming. And out of the blue, it would be like if somebody who, you know, was kind of a good but not great NBA player suddenly was like, oh, yeah, I'm the best player in the league by far now, better than LeBron, better than Westbrook, better than Steph Curry. Like, it just doesn't happen.
And I also think, to add in one more thing about the WNBA, I'm fascinated to see what the Phoenix Mercury do out of that 8th seed, because you guys put so much weight on preseason expectations, and also like when you rank March Madness NCAA, you actually take into account preseason rankings, because it almost feels like the Mercury have to regress to the mean upward, because they were predicted to be one of the top 2 to 3 teams in the WNBA.
I think hot takedown storylines to watch for the WNBA playoffs, trademark hot takedown, are what happens to Mercury and Ogumoke's dominance.
And also, I want to mention the Storm are a team that they went 16-18, but their point differential says that they should have gone 20-14. So they could be a team that pulls upsets and becomes kind of a Cinderella.
And also, do the layoff of the byes affect the performance?
Right.
Of
lots to watch for in the WNBA playoffs.
That's right.
That's your little viewing guide. We'll check back in as it winds its way towards the finals. And before we keep going, let's hear from our other sponsor this week. Hot Takedown is sponsored by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. Rocket Mortgage is a completely online process that lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using your phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinancing in just a few minutes. Get a custom mortgage solution at your own pace, whenever and wherever you want. So if you're looking to refinance or buy a home, check out Rocket Mortgage today at quickenloans.com/takedown. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender. It's licensed in all 50 states, and its NMLS consumeraccess.org number is 3030. Okay, now on to soccer, where a special treat, our global globe-trotting itinerant soccer senior soccer correspondent Mike Goodman is here with us in the studio. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Chad.
Mike, normally people can read your writing on ESPN FC or listen to your speaking on Double Pivot, your soccer podcast. But today you are here to help us make sense of a rivalry that goes back generations. By generations, I mean, what, 10 years or so, 15 years? Which is Jose Mourinho versus Pep Guardiola. Mourinho is now the coach for Man United. Guardiola is now the coach for Man City. And they've had sort of diverging paths since they've come to the English Premier League a little bit, at least in the first five games here.
They've certainly had a diverging week.
Yes. And so they're both hugely accomplished coaches in their past life. I'm going to ask you to fill me in rather than me butchering their resumes. But importantly, Mourinho with Man United has not had an auspicious debut. In the first five games, United is has three wins, two losses. They've lost in the Europa Cup, whereas across the city, in four-man city, Guardiola is 5-0, and is playing, you know, the beautiful game.
He's won in the Champions League. They've torched everybody they've played, like, decidedly.
So one of the things I want to discuss is those two coaches and the resumes, whatever else, but I also want to frame it within a conversation we were having a little bit last week around Belichick and Brady and how you know which player, or how you know if the player or the coach is really the key to success. And we've been saying, well, when Brady sits, that's one time where you can figure out if Belichick can keep the same level of success going. Maybe it's Belichick who's the mastermind. Similarly, here we have coaches moving around to different teams quite a bit, and perhaps that clues us into the quality of the coach, which is something we talk about a lot on Hot Take.
Yeah, no, it's a good place to start, because City and United both hired new coaches this summer, and they finished tied last year in the Premier League, with City qualifying for the Champions League and fourth on goal difference. So, I mean, they're starting from someplace that you think is very, very close, and then you're bringing in these two managers who have, you know, tremendous history in the league, you know, in the world, tremendous history with each other. And so there is a lot of a question. I mean, I do think that City was considered coming in a better team based on talent. Their fourth place finish was disappointing last year. Manchester United's fifth place finish was more expected. Maybe United spent more money bringing in star players this summer. I mean, so there's a lot to judge, and it's really early in the season. But Guardiola has sort of hit the ground running, and they're scary good already. They're scary good five games in. And United has struggled a little bit.
Well, what do you know about each coach's philosophy? Because I would think that there are certain coaches whose tactical philosophy allows them to hit the ground running easier, meaning, like, you know, is there an intricate defense and offense and all that?
The expectation would actually maybe be that Guardiola would take longer. It's maybe not fair, but his reputation is as a guru, a tactical, brilliant mind who does things differently than anybody else and better than anybody else. And Mourinho, by contrast, because they've been contrasted for their entire careers, gets the reputation of being like an ultimate pragmatist. He brings players together. They're a little more defensive. They're a little less tactically unique. But he creates an esprit de corps, and, you know, players love him or hate him, but they play for him. Obviously, the truth is going to be somewhat less polarized than that. And Mourinho absolutely has sort of identifiable tactical defensive traits that he instills in his teams. Mourinho is also coming off a giant failure at Chelsea last year, where he got fired, you know, a third of the way, halfway through the season. So there are questions as to the continued success of the way he manages.
Mourinho has lost 14 of his last 32 matches when you link the two teams together. This is coming from a guy who's widely considered one of the best coaches in the world, right?
He was certainly widely considered one of the two best coaches in the world until last year with Chelsea.
And the other one being Guardiola.
Guardiola.
So they have this really fascinating rivalry that, as an American sports fan, I didn't really know about. But a lot of shit talk, basically, between the two of them. And with Mourinho, again, who's the more losing coach this year, at one point basically saying that, like, Guardiola chooses easy teams to win with, whereas Mourinho is really the one who can, like, create a program.
Which is pretty rich coming from the manager of Manchester United, who are one of the, you know, Jose Mourinho's career has been Manchester United, Chelsea, Real Madrid, before Real Madrid, Inter Milan before Inter Milan, Chelsea again. I mean, those are big teams. So, you know.
But this idea of strategically going places in order to kind of look good reminds me of something, a theory that our friend Chase Stewart has about Bill Parcells, the old NFL coach of the Patriots and Cowboys and Jets and so forth, the Giants.
Giants, come on.
I mean, I would actually put Giants at the first of that
list. I was going in reverse chronological order, yeah, all right, Kate. Cool. In any event, so Bill Parcells, you know, always kind of took over teams. He left teams when they were pretty good, but perhaps on the precipice of falling apart. And he had gotten everything that he could out of them, and then joined teams that were kind of primed for some kind of upward regression, you know, to the mean or something. And I think the Cowboys, when he took over them, had some absurdly, you know, record that was out of step with their Pythagorean or something. And so Chase always kind of theorized, like, is he secretly a stat head and kind of understands regression to the mean and games it so that he, in his first year especially, has these dramatic improvements and it's kind of just all a statistical artifact?
Yeah. Hot Takedown listeners will remember that Neil helped our colleague at 538, Blake Terrell, find a new team, partly based on bandwagon index.
Mm-hmm.
Neil, what if you became a consultant for head coaches who are out of
yeah,
the league?
Yeah, and tell them what team
to join up with.
Going to regress to the mean upward.
Exactly. And maybe, like, what's your window, right? Do you want to wait 2 years because right now the Vikings are on the upswing?
Are you updating your resume?
Yeah.
Yet?
Yes, of
this
course. I'm on LinkedIn right now.
Neil.
I would want at least a quarter.
Well, absolutely. You and I are running front of the house, but we're doing business. The business end. Guys, I don't know what your role is.
I think Bill Parcells actually already is doing this. So,
all right, back to soccer, I suppose. God, that's American. We're just dragging
football.
I'm about to ask a question to relate it somehow to America, but that's cool.
Ask your question.
Well, no, I need to remember my question. It's definitely what it has to do with America.
You want me to?
Oh, okay, I got it. If you can explain to me, when it comes to soccer, it seems like the way we talk about managers, it's as if soccer believes that managers have this, like, unique control over the game. I think in the U.S. there are certain sports where we do feel that way, perhaps football being one of them, but then there's others where basketball's kind of morphed into a place where you're like, of course you need a decent coach, but really it's player-driven. Where does soccer exist on that?
So culturally, soccer, especially in England, has for a long time subscribed to the manager controls everything. It's probably not that. I mean, there's a lot of soccer that is sort of your finances and your skill level control your destiny. But what is true is that coaches can dramatically change styles. It's an open question as to how much changing a style is going to make a team out, you know, overperform or underperform their talent level. But they'll look different on the field, right? Like, Pep Guardiola comes into Manchester City, they visually look different than they did. Same thing with Jose Mourinho at Manchester United.
We're not talking about the different color kits. We're saying that they're moving differently on the pitch.
Different players have different roles. They pass to different areas of the field. Those are real things, and they're real things that are easy to see for fans watching the game. So there is, you know, there is this idea that managers matter, and they matter in very real ways. It's just not clear how much of the stuff that they do that matters that changes ultimately, you know, affects the record at the end of the day.
So to that point, I read this great quote that was put together from our producer Joe Sykes in our little prep pack that we use, which is very very British. It's from The Guardian. To watch United and City at the moment is like witnessing an elephant and a leopard. Mourinho's teams are lumbering, ideas poor, and second rate virtually everywhere. Pep Guardiola's side seem to have 11 light-footed, brilliant-minded players who together form a terrifying unit that so far no opposition can quell.
Well, God, I can see why the narrative about these two coaches has been, like, solidified over the years by language and columnists like that, I'm assuming.
Look, a lot of that language is the result of their two, like, of their reputations, right? Because Guardiola's reputation is that he plays beautifully, and Mourinho's reputation is that he plays ugly but does it to win.
So that's part of my question is, like, does pace matter in soccer? It seems like that's just narrative and has nothing to do. And we talked about this a little bit, I think, during the UEFA Cup, where Portugal won despite not really playing that beautifully. And they didn't have a tournament that made you sort of think about how soccer could sort of.
There are
be
a
the
lot
game.
Of tired arguments about whether there's a moral imperative to play in a certain way. Those arguments are almost always deployed against teams that win, even though they're not playing in a way that, you know, non-fans are, enjoy watching. I think it's silly. I think that it's also something that fans can get very invested in, and that the, you know, it's one of those things that fans enjoy. But in terms of making a team better or worse, look, Guardiola makes a team better. Guardiola also makes a team more entertaining to watch, even if you're not a fan of that team.
Now, is some of that a matter of kind of finding the right players? Like, the system is what makes the beauty or ugly pragmatism of a team? And is it easier to find players for each of those particular systems? Or is this a case of maybe, you know, Guardiola, again, found players that were sort of suited to his system, whereas Mourinho, you know, has ill-suited players?
I mean, I think for the first point, we have to be clear. Both of these guys work at really rich teams, and they always work at really rich teams. So it should not be a problem to find get the players that they want to play how they want to play. Now, Guardiola has a track record of developing a number of players in ways that lots of people didn't expect that they would be able to develop. He's turned, how much credit he gets from Messi is a oft-debated question. You can ignore Messi. You can look at a lot of other players, guys like Jerome Boateng in Germany, who have just developed into really good players under Guardiola. And Mourinho doesn't have that track record. Fair or unfair, his reputation is that he sort of ignores players with potential for more established veterans that are going to win right now, that he's going to put the guys in the field that give him the best chance to win right now and not develop talent.
All right, so let's wrap up with just sort of a question that gets us back to this rivalry and what we've learned about it after just five games. And I recognize that that's early yet, but especially when you combine it with the Chelsea reign of Mourinho, are we seeing some real evidence, in your opinion, that one coach is better than another, or is Mourinho just, you know, could be in the middle of the season all of a sudden the team turns around and goes on a run?
I think we're seeing really good. This is about the top of the range you would have expected from Manchester City, and that speaks really, really well of Guardiola. This is closer to the average range of what you might have expected from Manchester United. So should it be damning for Mourinho? No. You can't avoid looking at them in sort of relation to each other. It's definitely been a better start of the season as a data point for Guardiola than Mourinho.
All right. Mike Goodman, such a pleasure to have you in the studio.
Oh, it's great to be here.
Thanks, right. Mike. Thanks.
Well, we'll talk to you again from D.C. next time. But thanks for coming through.
All right, absolutely.
Okay, now on to Significant Digit, which is when Neil Payne basically at this point brings us a telling number from the world of sports. Neil Payne, I hear that you've been watching an obscure hockey tournament that I...
Is it really obscure, Chad?
It is.
It's on ESPN, wall to wall, I feel like.
But Neil, this is my thing. It's hard enough to get people to watch hockey, and now we're supposed to watch the Hockey World Cup. I'm sure it's great. I have not been watching, so it's obscure to me.
Yeah, I cannot say that I was, following it incredibly closely in the run-up to the tournament itself, but I believe they started on Saturday. It is this, it's Olympic-esque, but it includes these kind of weird teams, which is where our SIGDIG comes from. Our SIGDIG is the number 23. That is the age, that is the kind of maximum cutoff to be part of this North American team that includes basically the best young players from Canada and the U.S. that are not part of the Canada and U.S. teams. There are Canadian teams. They're the favorites, as you might expect. And there's a U.S. team that's kind of horribly underperforming. And then there's this North American team, which is made up of players age 23 and under. And it also happens to have just a ridiculous amount of young talent
on the team. So North America could have to play the U.S. or Canada?
Sure, yeah. I mean, probably more likely Canada.
And can the U.S. team have players of any age?
Yes, so the Canadian team and the U.S. team can have their national team. They can pick teams, you know,
and they better stand for the
anthem. So are there people over the age of 23, under the age of 23, on North America and Canada?
No.
Sorry, on U.S. and Canada.
No, so the Canadian
so
and
basically
American
it's
teams.
Our over 23 team.
Yeah, it's kind of two over 23 teams and one combined under 23 team.
It's like not enough people, according to hockey fans, are watching hockey to begin with. Why wouldn't you just want our U.S. team to have our best players, Canada have their best players. Why would it be split at eight?
Well,
do you have
so
the answer,
I
Neil?
Feel like they needed to. I think this was done in order to fill out kind of an even number of teams. So there's Canada, Czech Republic, Finland, Russia, Sweden, the U.S., and then there's a Europe team that is based on the best players from the rest of Europe.
I don't want to watch something that they're just filling out rosters for.
But the filler team, which North America kind of went into the tournament, they were not considered to be a very strong team going into the tournament because, you know, it's a bunch of kids and the kind of established in their prime players are on Canada and the U.S. And this North American team went out and friggin' smoked Finland on Sunday, 4-0. And they have an absurd collection of the past few drafts worth of number one overall picks, including Connor McDavid, who has been described, many players have been described as the next Gretzky, but he might actually be the next Gretzky. They have Nathan McKinnon. They have Austin Matthews. They have Ryan Nugent Hopkins. They have Jack Eichel, who was considered sort of the runner-up to Connor McDavid,
really...
the consolation prize. What I'm trying to say,
stretching.
Seth Jones, who is the son
NBA Seth
player,
Jones?
Popeye Jones. If you
Popeye
will.
Jones!
Neil, stop!
What I'm trying to say is this team is actually ridiculously stacked. Now, they did lose to Russia in a very exciting 4-3 game in which their comeback fell short. But the odds on this team have improved from they were 11-1 before the tournament to win the tournament. During the summer, they were 20-1 at one point, and now they are the third biggest favorite in the whole tournament, according to the betting odds. So this team is like ridiculously fast.
We heard.
And so what I'm trying to say is maybe next time they should think about maybe not constructing a super team only on the basis
bring
of
some young people
arbitrary cutoffs of age.
All right, whew, that was good. You want to know what my sig dig is for you?
You need a glass of water.
Oh no! Please do not say the length of Tebow's home run. Please,
one the number of home runs Tim Tebow hit during batting practice today at Mets Instructional League.
Were they just lobbing softballs in there for him to unload on?
He's garbage. He's garbage.
All right, that will do it for this week's show before Neil kills me. Neil, thanks for restraining your violent impulses all show long.
Anytime, Chad.
Kate Fagan, thanks for senior ministering with us.
I'm a minister, not an administer, right?
Yeah.
Cool.
Whew.
You're welcome. Thank you, Chad.
Don't worry. Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast administrator is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow, Jorge Estrada, and Jonathan Yales. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. Find us on your favorite podcasting app. If you're not already subscribed, subscribe. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can also leave a rating and or a review. That helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.